From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You know, most weeks we could say something about Fox News, like Bill O'Reilly's show stalking critics with camera crews, for example. But usually we don't, partly because Fox News won't talk to us and partly because, well, it gets boring. But this week, Fox News crossed a line by actively embracing, some would say co-sponsoring, some might say co-opting, the Tax Day anti-tax and government spending tea parties across the country.
Americans outraged over unfair and crippling taxes as they fight for their future.
Glenn Beck's at the Alamo. Neil Cavuto's live in Sacramento and Greta is in Washington, D.C. Can't get to a tea party? Fox Nation hosts a virtual tea party and you can check it out on the site for the location of a tea party in your area. Again,
as tea parties sweep the nation, we're there with total fair and balanced network coverage. Live.
Was Fox News covering a news event or helping to create one? That's what Fox News' Neil Cavuto wanted to know.
Young lady, you're here. You don't have to be here. Tell the truth. Was it the rally or me?
Neil, I am a huge fan of yours. It was both.
Was this a grassroots expression of a widely held frustration or an anti-Obama rally organized by right-wing pundits and politicians? Or both? The mainstream media, except for Fox News, couldn't quite make up their mind, being generally leery of rallies and marches, which, after all, are crafted as media events. That's why during the Bush administration, the media were repeatedly slammed by the left for undercovering anti-war rallies while flocking like pigeons to events staged by politicians. So maybe Fox News regular Michelle Malkin was right.
The reason the mainstream media, most of the mainstream media, isn't covering it is because they don't believe it's real. This is real. These people are here, and they're here to stay.
Ditto, said former House Majority Leader Republican Dick Armey, whose group Freedom Works was a co-sponsor of the Tea Parties.
This is a bona fide American uprising of real people.
Maybe, as Fox News' Glenn Beck sagely observed, the mainstream media, except for Fox News, just doesn't understand real people.
I don't think they are capable of understanding. But since the media and Stephen Colbert are watching, I'm going to speak very, very slowly.
Certainly, MSNBC's left-leaning anchors saw the day as a movable feast of freaks and devoted many minutes to teabag jokes. But most of the coverage focused on whether this event, sponsored in part by Army's group Freedom Works and promoted by Republican elder statesman Newt Gingrich, was truly nonpartisan, and whether, having been largely promoted by conservative talk radio and Fox News, it was genuinely grassroots. After all, even some of the event's organizers say they were inspired by another media event, CNBC's Rick Santelli's made-for-TV rant from the Chicago trading floor a couple of months back, when he told Obama that the people didn't want him to bail out the mortgages of losers, but instead
reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water.
That got the crowd going.
We're thinking of having a Chicago tea party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
It was a great TV moment, and the CNBC folks wanted it to last.
Hey, Rick, can you do that one more time? Just get the mob behind you again. I love it.
I have the camera pull way out. Yeah.
You can't just do it at will, can you, Rick?
Yeah, do it at will. Let's see.
And he did, which seems to be what Fox News was trying to do on Wednesday. Some of the event's organizers have mixed feelings about that.
Adam Brandon represents one of those event organizers, Freedom Works, chaired, as you heard, by former House Majority Leader Dick Armey. Freedom Works' heavy involvement in planning and organizing the tea parties is one reason the Tax Day gatherings have been called AstroTurf. But Brandon says his group is just helping the grassroots get off the ground.
When folks come to us and we help them organize, you know, we consider that great grassroots. And what I consider astroturfing is when something comes together that claims to have a wide variety of support when it really isn't there. So if you look at our heritage on the issue, we've been making a lot of noise for years now, going back to Republican presidents and to Republican Congresses. It's just people are starting to pay attention to us now, which is very exciting for us.
Could that have anything to do with the participation of Fox News, which has just embraced the notion of tea parties and flogged it relentlessly on its air, including just about all of its hosts, for them to be cheerleading you is obviously very significant. But what I want to know is it significant in a good way, or can it have a backlash attached to it?
Well, it's definitely significant in a good way in that it gets our message out. But we've also had folks interviewed on all major networks as of this point. Tonight, Army is going to be interviewed on CNN. So we're getting decent coverage all over the place. So I welcome Fox's involvement, and I'm very pleased that everyone, you know, it's obviously reached your attention, and that's good for us.
I sense hesitation from you in your answers. You seem loath to diss Fox News, but you don't seem entirely delighted to me, as I read between the lines, with their full-throated participation. What is the risk of being associated with this particular media organization at a moment like this?
I'm trying to answer your question as best as possible here, but I do appreciate Fox's coverage, but I'm not overly concerned about it, because I believe probably a week or two from now, we're going to be moving on to the next big issue. What I'm more interested in is the types of media that are going to continue to follow this taxpayer issue.
Well, I don't ask the question for no reason. Mm-hmm. Eric Odom of mm-hmm. TaxDayTeaParty.com mm-hmm. was complaining that the Republicans are trying to, quote, ride on the brand that we created. Mm-hmm. And, you know, implied that he wasn't necessarily delighted to be giving them that free ride. If we can assume for a moment that Fox is essentially a house organ for the GOP, mm-hmm. do you share Eric Odom's sentiments that they're kind of freeloading here?
I do agree with him that it's very dangerous for the GOP to jump on this. We are a nonpartisan organization. We are fiscal conservatives. So obviously many in the GOP like to hear what we say. But we're not trying to elect GOP folks. What we're trying to do is own the fear of politicians, whether they're from Republicans or Democrats.
Finally, going back to the questions of astroturfing, mm-hmm. and now that this is all played out and mm-hmm. considering the controversy that has erupted over the real grassroots versus fake ones, do you wish that your organization had behaved differently in trying to mobilize the turnout on April 15th?
Absolutely not. When we get our jobs in our organization, the first thing you do is you sit down with some of Saul Alinsky's books, Rules for Radicals. And we read that book and we study that book. And everything that we've been trying to do here comes straight out of those pages. So we're very pleased. You know, we have spent almost $0 on this effort other than staff time. And we've got tremendous media coverage of the movement. So for us, this has been a very, very successful tool to organize and to bring new people into, you know, the small government conservative movement.
There is one last thing. Mm-hmm. When you appear at the Atlanta rally, will mm-hmm. you be in civilian clothing?
Oh, actually, I am a Revolutionary War reenactor, so I will be showing up in a late war Continental Line uniform.
Tell me about your shoes.
There's no right or left. It's just kind of a blob of leather with a buckle on it.
No right or left, eh? Only on your shoes, my friend. Only on your shoes. Adam, thank you very much for joining us.
I really appreciate it, and we hope to speak with you guys again soon.
Adam Brandon is press secretary for FreedomWorks, one of the organizers of Wednesday's Tax Day Tea Parties. In Sweden on Friday, a court found the four co-founders of the popular file-sharing website The Pirate Bay guilty of assisting the distribution of illegal content online, convicted essentially of aiding and abetting in the wholesale theft of intellectual property. The four were sentenced to a year in jail and fined $3.6 million. Some were surprised by the verdict, as Pirate Bay doesn't itself host or store illegal content, but rather links those who wish to illegally download songs and movies with those who possess them, much in the way some states ban radar detectors because their only purpose is to evade speed limit laws. Mats Levon, a Swedish technology writer, was one who marveled that the prosecution prevailed despite any evidence linking Pirate Bay to the stolen property itself.
And that's what makes this case so particular, that the prosecutor can make it believable that these guys helped the file sharers so much that they should be convicted, even though no files were stored on their site.
Before we get to the larger ramifications of this case, what does this verdict mean for file sharing in Sweden?
What's kind of particular with the Swedish population is that it's very homogeneous. And when something is coming up in Sweden, a kind of new way of behaving, you will see everybody moving in the same direction. In this case, I suppose that people have been scared of being spotted doing file sharing, so everyone stops at the same time. On the other hand, you could say that those who have stopped are probably just common people, could be parents file sharing files to have movies for their kids, doing just a couple of things a month maybe. All those people have stopped, but the real bad guys, those who upload lots of movies and download lots of movies, they can go on for themselves because they wouldn't care about such a decision. So you left the field open for the bad guys, if you could put it that way.
What do you think this verdict will mean globally?
I don't think that file sharing will go down that much. In the first place, we can see that Pirate Bay, the site, is still live, and it will probably go on being live, even if these guys go to jail. They have so many ways of keeping it up. On the other hand, when legislation comes after this kind of technology, it actually accelerates the interest of those persons involved to find new ways to use the technology that would not be reached by legal forces anyway. And one example of this is that you already have a second generation of the BitTorrent technology called OneSwarm, and it preserves the file sharer's privacy, so you couldn't see who actually shares what file.
Are you suggesting that Pandora's box is now so wide open that not only do businesses have to change the way they do business, but laws have to change to accommodate what is now possible?
That's my belief, actually. I believe in copyright, but I think that when you have such a strong technological development changing so many things, I think that the copyright that was designed in a completely different environment, well, everything was physical, actually, it will have to change in some way. But I don't know what. That's a big question.
Mats, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mats Levan is the IT and telecom editor at the Swedish magazine Ny Teknik. He's also a fellow with Stanford University's Innovation Journalism Program, and you can read his reporting on the Pirate Bay trial at CNET.com.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On The Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On The Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A spontaneous uprising in Moldova that began on April 6th had all the makings of the popular revolutions that have swept through former Russian republics like Georgia and Ukraine in the last few years. Pictures of thousands of young Moldovans taking to the streets seemingly out of nowhere in protest of a dubious election victory for the last communist regime in Europe. In the previous protests, much of the sophisticated organization was attributed to the internet and cell phones. This time, it was that latest democratic tech tool, Twitter, that supposedly organized the masses. And so it was quickly dubbed the Twitter Revolution. Ethan Zuckerman is a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. He's been looking at what actually happened, and he joins us. Ethan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Can you start by laying out for us what were the first indications that this mass of protesters in Moldova had been organized?
Well, what we saw in Moldova was a lot of discussion in blogs, on Facebook, lots of different social media, with youth, particularly youth on the left, very upset, believing that the elections were rigged. And then we saw street protests with more than 10,000 people out in the streets of Chisinau a week ago Tuesday. And people very, very quickly made a link between social media and the actual manifestations in the streets. Near as we can tell, the first to the scene was the Telegraph in the UK, with a story linking Twitter as a causal factor in all of this. And then there was a thoughtful, although perhaps a little breathless, post from my friend Evgeny Morozov on a very influential blog called Net Effect, which declared this the Twitter Revolution. And then from the press standpoint of this, we were off to the races. It showed up in the New York Times the next day as the Twitter Revolution, and that meme propagated in a lot of different directions.
Now, one thing you discovered as you looked at the data is that most of the tweets emanated not from the scene of the protest, but elsewhere, because there aren't many Twitter subscribers in Moldova. But, of course, that doesn't mean that Twitter wasn't a catalyst in what happened. How big a part did it play?
My take on it at this point is that Twitter probably wasn't all that important in organizing the demonstrations. Where I think they were enormously important is helping people, particularly people in the Moldovan diaspora, keep up with the events in real time. One thing to keep in mind is that Moldova has a huge population living abroad. It's more than 25% of the country. And they were really attached to Twitter as a source of information. Roughly a quarter of all of the messages posted on Tuesday, the day of the actual demonstrations, were what we call retweets. It's basically saying, hey, I'm quoting this speaker who said the following. And mostly those retweets were reports from people who either were in the square or had news from the square. What you saw on that Tuesday was really people trying to find ways to sort of spontaneously organize a newsroom. By Wednesday, a lot of what seems to be going on in the Twittering is a sort of self-congratulatory, hey, we just held a revolution over Twitter. Isn't this exciting? Twitter will change the world. Then by Thursday, Twitter's now being used by a small group of people discussing the events, discussing who's gotten arrested, discussing what to do next. And fascinatingly, it looks like it's being used as a disinformation channel by forces who might have been aligned with the government, essentially trying to scare people away from demonstrating again.
Putting aside how much Twitter was involved, was it in fact a revolution of any kind? The communist regime remains intact. After 4 or 5 days, the protests petered out.
The protests do seem to have forced a vote recount. The government was responding to quite a bit of protester pressure. I think the other thing that's going on is that the revolution, if it was a revolution, has gotten people in the diaspora very involved. As I sit down and analyze the Twitter feeds, I've found one Moldovan in the U.S. who posted more than 1,000 messages over the course of 5 days. So there are some incredibly passionate people who are now paying extremely close attention to politics. But in terms of actually changing the government, so far, not a revolution on that score.
Twitter has captured the imagination of the press, perhaps most especially because it doesn't seem that anybody quite understands why it exists. And here was an opportunity to attribute to it a rare sort of power.
There's no better way to get a story out there than to pick the technological flavor of the month and to attach to it. What a better way to get people to pay attention to Moldova than to link it to the technological story of the moment.
All right, then finally, to what new media application will the next Eastern European revolution be attributed?
I assume at that point we will have perfected telepathy through electronic devices. I would look for whatever's getting Silicon Valley funding, and roughly 6 months after that, you'll probably see it being used effectively by activist movements. Activists are great alpha users for tech.
As always, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ethan Zuckerman is a fellow at the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-founder of the blog globalvoicesonline.org. Information passed by word-of-mouth, studies show, is more trusted even than info from official sources, and vastly more than commercial advertising. And with the advent of social media tools that exponentially increase word-of-mouth's reach, no wonder that marketers have jumped in to exploit its power. Some have done so openly, others by stealth, for instance, by compensating bloggers and Twitterers for hyping brands online. Now the Federal Trade Commission is stepping in to ensure that the shout-out for an acne cleanser from a Facebook friend isn't an ad in disguise. My old pal Andy Cernovitz is author of Word of Mouth Marketing, and he joins me. Hey, Andy, welcome to OTM.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the FTC, tell me the various ways marketers try to fake word of mouth.
There's two big ways that people try to sneak past you. Either they lie about who they are, so you think you're reading an honest comment on a blog, and it's actually a marketer in disguise with 20 different logins, or they're paying other people to recommend something on their blogs or email or Facebook and not telling you that those people have been paid. You usually see it most from either sort of low-end, sleazy, like health remedies and get-rich-quick schemes in that end, or you see it from entertainment companies, from folks who are out there to hype a song or a movie.
Some of this is called paper post, right? Bloggers getting X number of cents for every time they post a favorable appraisal of a new song or something.
Yeah, you see a couple of big operations. One company is actually called Paper Post, and it pays you to write blog posts about stuff. There's a new one called Magpie that pays you to send stuff out over your Twitter account under your name. And where it gets more interesting is the way things get repeated in social media. And this is what concerns me more, is that a company might pay through this paper post service to get 200 people to blog something about them. And it says this was a paid placement in the blog post. So technically that's okay. They did say it was paid for. But then those blog posts get repeated on their Facebook page and then on Twitter, and then someone else copies it, and suddenly 10 times more posts have the exact same paid review where we've lost the disclosure that made it honest. I mean, really, the big idea here is this word disclosure. And what it says is it's okay to pay for coverage. That's called advertising. But you have to say, and now a word from our sponsors.
Which is where the FTC comes in. Tell me about its new rules.
Well, what's interesting is they're clarifying old rules. It has always been illegal to advertise something and not tell people you were paid for it. So there's nothing really new here. They're clarifying it and they're making it stronger. So the FTC is openly saying, if you're taking money to advertise something, you have to tell people you were paid for it. They are making it clear that that now applies to social media and blogs and Twitter. And they're also making it clear that it's not just the company who's responsible, but the bloggers are responsible. If they're getting paid, they're no longer independent people with free speech rights. They are media who are taking advertising, and they better reveal that they're being paid for the advertising.
So let's talk about Twitter for a moment. Does anyone pay attention to a tweet that is clearly really an ad?
We're about to find out. If the first three letters were AD colon, it's an ad, and you could write on the side of your Twitter page, you know, I take advertising, look for the words AD colon. And out if that's good enough for the followers of a particular Twitterer. The Huffington Post might decide to have every other tweet be an ad, and you may say it's worth it because they've got good content. But if Joe Schmo starts putting everything out as an ad, you may say, I don't care what this guy has to say, and I don't want to get his advertising. And that's what we're going to have to figure out as we get used to this new media.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Cernovitz is author of Word of Mouth Marketing. He runs the Blog Council, a group for heads of social media at big companies, which, word has it, is like the totally best blog council anywhere. In August 2008, an explosion rocked a chemical plant in Institute, West Virginia. It killed two plant employees and raised fears of local residents who had cause to worry. The Bayer Crop Science plant there is reportedly the twin of the Union Carbide facility in Bhopal, India, that killed thousands in the aftermath of a toxic chemical leak in 1984, one of the worst industrial accidents in history. Enter the U.S. government and its Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. The board wields power solely by investigating such events and then making its findings public. But last month, just as it was about to release the first phase of its findings at a public forum, the board was instructed not to disclose at all. Bayer had invoked a seldom, if ever, used part of the post-9/11 anti-terrorism law, claiming that details of the explosion are, quote, sensitive security information. Thus, the feds have been muzzled, at least in part, by their own law. The case has piqued the interest of Congress, which plans to look into the matter on April 21st, but the board remains anxious that the public may still be left in the dark. John Breslund is the chairman and CEO of the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. He joins us. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell me first about the board. What is its mandate and what authority, power, does it have?
Well, the easiest way to describe the Chemical Safety Board is to think of the National Transportation Safety Board. They do the major plane crashes. railroad accidents, major car crashes. We do exactly the same thing as they do, except we do it for oil refineries and chemical plants. And our mission is really to investigate major accidents and come up with recommendations, conclusions as to what happened, and most importantly, make the information public.
Now, the death of two workers is by no means trivial, but the notion of an explosion at a Bhopal twin must have been terrifying to people in your shop.
I live in West Virginia, and I knew that because of the history of the facility, there was going to be a lot of community interest in this accident, probably more community interest than any other accident that we have investigated. And I believe that has turned out to be correct.
Your board was preparing to issue an interim report, mid-investigation report.
Yeah.
And along comes Bayer Crop Science and its lawyers to say what?
They came along and said, we have supplied a lot of information to you. You as a government agency have the right to receive that information. However, the Coast Guard has told them that that information under the Maritime Transportation Safety Act is called sensitive security information and cannot be disclosed to the public.
And you said the Maritime Coast Guard, what? Had you ever heard of this thing before?
Well, we knew that since 9/11, a couple of different things had happened. One, MTSA had been passed, but we didn't pay much attention to it. It wasn't something that really enters into any of our thinking when we're doing investigations.
But Bayer said it was relevant because their facility has a dock on the Kanawha River there and therefore qualifies under Coast Guard jurisdiction.
Correct. And they went to the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard, according to Bayer, agreed with them. And Bayer then came to us and said, if you go to the public meeting, there's certain information that you cannot disclose.
Well, let me ask you for a moment to distance yourself from the particulars of this case and look at the principle at issue. Do security considerations ever trump the public's right to know about what dangers may be lurking in the very communities?
Well, from our perspective, we have no interest at all in our investigation in what would be considered security aspects of their operation. How many guards do they have? Are the guards armed? How high are their fences? What sort of security cameras do they have? That's got nothing to do with what we're doing, which is investigating the technical details of what happened inside the plant on the evening in question.
But if there's a methyl isocyanate tank within a stone's throw of the explosion site and another underground tank that can hold three times the amount of poison that killed so many people in India 25 years ago, I guess that's something that the residents of Institute have a right to know, no?
Yes, and that information actually is publicly available right now. All you have to do is go to an EPA reading room and ask to see the document that's called their risk management plan, and any citizen can get that information. It's readily available, so there's nothing secretive about it.
The Chemical Safety and Hazard Board doesn't have a whole lot of power. You know, it can't issue fines. You know, I don't even know if you have subpoena power, but your whole raison d'etre is to investigate and report on industrial accidents. You're Paul Revere. The British are coming.
Okay.
You're put on your horse and you're told, go from town to town, but don't say anything.
It's very frustrating for us to be put in this position where you're not allowed to disclose, or people say you're not allowed to disclose what we consider to be appropriate information. Just listing the chemicals that they have and the amounts of the chemicals and the causes of the explosion, it just doesn't make sense to me.
You know, in fairness to Bayer, considering what happened in Bhopal and considering the terror climate under which we live today, you know, they could be excused for being a little nervous about more people rather than fewer, knowing about the location of methyl isocyanate tanks in their plant and institute. No?
I think the other point to bring up is that there are many chemical plants in the United States. There are 150 oil refineries. I worked in the chemical industry for many years. These chemical plants have a certain level of hazard that's been dealt with, hopefully appropriately. What we worry about as an agency is that if this particular situation is allowed to continue. Every time we do an investigation at a chemical plant that might be covered by either the MTSA rules or the chemical plant security rules, they're going to say, you can't tell anybody about this. And we as an agency would be stymied in doing our job, and the public would be the worse.
Chairman Breslin, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
John Breslin is the chairman and CEO of the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. The board's West Virginia presentation is scheduled for April 23rd. We contacted Bayer Crop Science for a statement, and it says it remains committed to open dialogue and to cooperating with the Chemical Safety Board. As for discussing the so-called sensitive security information, Bayer Crop Science says, quote, manufacturers in the United States are required by law to identify certain sensitive security information about their sites, processes, and procedures. It is up to the United States Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security, not the manufacturers, to ultimately determine what is sensitive security information. Then, the manufacturer is obligated to keep such designated information confidential for security reasons. Our company has and will continue to adhere to the law.
Coming up, the spirit of independence returns to video games.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 2005, America's video game industry surpassed movie box office sales. Last year, global video game sales reportedly reached $32 billion, more than DVD and Blu-ray sales combined. And yet, video games seem to be stuck in a rut of predictable shooters and other high-resolution cliches.
The innovative spirit that marked the early days of video game development was crushed under the weight of the high-stakes, multi-million-dollar businesses built on the appeal of consoles like Microsoft's Xbox, Sony's PlayStation, and Nintendo's Wii. Now, independent game production is again on the rise because the geeks want it, the gamers want it, and more recently, as you'll hear, even giant producers like Microsoft want it. Clive Thompson, who writes for Wired and the New York Times Magazine, says that innovation started to creep back into game design after more than a decade in hiding about 7 years ago.
What happened was that it became possible to do your own game because Flash and Shockwave came along, which are like these little languages for programming something inside a browser. You know, you had tens of millions of people that could potentially play your game, and you could put it online and get it out there for free. So a lot of the young talent started going, well, I'll have my job where I'm the assistant animator for Scooby-Doo number 4, you know, something completely horrible, boring to play, boring to make. And in their spare time, they started saying, I'm going to try and design a little game on my own that is going to be played in Shockwave or Flash on a browser. And this was the real first boom, the first flowering in indie video games.
And you say that independent game designers are students of ludology?
Yeah. Ludology is the study of play, why we like to play, why we find meaning in it.
And what it doesn't mean is 3D graphics or other technological wizardry.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, play is play whether or not it's done on a computer or on grass, you know, or with dice and pens, right? What is a game? A game is just a bunch of quite arbitrary rules that you give to someone that give them a task to do that's actually, you know, difficult because you're limiting what they can do. You know, like when you're playing basketball, you stop dribbling, you can't go any further. That's a really arbitrary rule, but if you take it away, basketball isn't fun anymore. So what game design is the game design is not about thinking about visual things or graphics. It's about thinking about rules that make for a fun environment, a fun thing to do.
You say that console makers have structured the economics of the game industry in a way that's bred less creative games.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I wanted to make a game for the PlayStation 3, or the Xbox, or Wii, and I say, okay, I'm going to print 100,000 of these. Well, I have to pay a fee for every one of those 100,000 discs I print, even if they just sit in a warehouse and I never sell them. Games have become, just like Hollywood, a very expensive hit-based industry. So you make 10 games, they all cost $10 million. 9 of them flop, 1 of them is a hit, and it pays for all the other ones. So it's incredibly hard to make money in this industry, and that's why innovation has been very flat sometimes for years.
That's Clive Thompson. He'll be back in a few minutes. Now, the companies that make the consoles say they put those fees on every game disc to subsidize the artificially low price of the consoles. They sell them at a loss in order to build and maintain a mass audience. But some of them do concede that their industry could use an injection of the indie spirit. And so in 2006, Microsoft introduced its XNA Developer Kit, a set of programming tools that give amateurs the ability to make a game for the Xbox. Microsoft's Boyd Moulterer says that XNA makes it easy to create realistic backgrounds, 3D graphics, and dynamic sounds.
What XNA gives you is an environment on your Windows machine that allows you to write your game, test it out in your Windows machine, and send it over to a regular retail Xbox and see it running in all of its glory. Now, normally a development kit for the professional for an Xbox is, running $10,000 a piece, and this lets you get going for free on the Windows machine and for $100 a year on an Xbox. You do need to know how to write code, but you've got 99% of the box, especially the graphics ability, at your disposal.
When someone makes a game with XNA, how do they share it with other Xbox users?
You can package your game up and send it to one of your friends who also knows how to put it on their Xbox. Or you can submit it to the community games section on the Xbox, and that goes through a peer review system where other people like you are going to look at it and make sure you don't have naughty things in there. And then it goes up for sale, and everybody who's on Xbox Live can see it and download your game.
You said that peers review it to make sure there's no naughty things on it. I understand that Microsoft's policy is no porn, no Nazis, or no service.
That's basically right. The other thing we care a lot about is that you accurately describe your game so that anyone who's coming up to it can make their own informed decision on whether or not they want to download it. We very specifically do not review those games. We're very much leaving it up to the community to decide what comes through and what doesn't.
Do these amateur programmers really have a chance to make money, or is Microsoft really just exploiting the game community's desire to create?
Well, hopefully it's a little bit of both. I have hopes that someone in their basement will be able to make a decent piece of change if they make a good game.
Microsoft takes a third of that, right?
Roughly.
Having all these amateurs in on the process, do you think that's having any impact on the big game developers?
Oh, absolutely. One of the biggest problems in the industry is there is a lack of enough trained people who know how to make a game and have experience making games. So the big publishers are partly looking at this as a pool of people who are teaching themselves how to be in the industry. Second, there's some crazy new ideas that are coming out, and the big publishers are looking for their future titles. Third, just the fact of having a lot of niche titles that may not have a big audience but definitely speak to those people, it means that we have a huge variety and a huge number of choices for our customers.
Boy, do you like to play video games?
Yeah, I do.
What's the funnest program that's come from an amateur?
My favorite game to come out so far is The Dishwasher by James Silva. He started completely as an amateur. He made this game. He put it into the Dream Build Play contest that we have. It is fun.
It's just basically a shoot 'em up, isn't it?
Well, it is kind of a hack it up sort of game, but it is fun. It's that magic word that's hard to quantify and hard to qualify, but it's got it.
Boyd Moulterer is manager of Microsoft's XNA program. James Silva, former dishwasher, created the game Dishwasher Dead Samurai using the XNA tools. And he won Microsoft's Dream Build Play contest, which gave his game wide distribution on Microsoft's Live Arcade platform. Silva studied computer programming in college and made his game while getting a master's. He created games before, but this one was something special.
Being able to deploy on a console, I mean, that just, it was such a big deal to me.
So tell me a little bit about Dishwasher. It seems a little autobiographical.
Yeah. Well, the story, I got the idea for the concept like 5 or 6 years ago when I was working as a dishwasher at a little cafe. I just got really, really taken by the idea that there should be a game where a dishwasher just flips out and kills bad guys. You know?
Did this thought occur to you while you were doing dishes?
Yes.
Do you think that there's something that you can do that those big studios can't?
Well, there's definitely more room for just experimentation. And I kept saying to myself, like, who the heck has an idea about making a game about a dishwasher? When you've got a big studio, you've got so much money on the line that they really like to vet concepts to make sure that they can sell the concept.
What makes your game fun?
It's got a pace that's really just crazy. It's really visceral. It's really responsive. And it's pretty unique in these strategies that you can develop. It's not so much a button masher as like a strategic button masher. And there's so much, you know, weird little nuance in it. You can really do awesome if you figure it all out.
Now that you've quit your dishwasher job, do you have another game up your sleeve?
Yeah, I've got two of them I kind of whipped into shape while I was waiting for dishwasher to go through rounds of testing.
And what are those called?
One is called Zombie Smashers X4 Guitar Apocalypse. And one is called ZP2K9, and I don't remember what that is supposed to stand for.
So, do you think you can make a living at this?
Oh, I hope so. So far, I think it looks doable. We'll see how the sales go through. I quit my day job, as everyone is warned not to do in life. You know, if you go eat at a restaurant and I'm washing your dishes, you'll know if things didn't go quite as well as they were planned.
James, thank you very much.
Sure.
James Silva is the creator of Dishwasher Dead Samurai. Okay, so Clive, have you ever wanted to design a game?
Not really. It's very, very hard to do. Designing a game is like designing a constitution for a country. You have to think through human behavior and what your rules are going to do.
Writer Clive Thompson says that independent creators have been exploring human behavior with their PC and internet-based games for years. But when indies made the leap to consoles, it opened up a whole new world.
A lot of people play video games on computers, but way more play them on these consoles, like a PlayStation or a Wii or an Xbox. You know, if you just design games for computers, it's a little bit like saying, well, you know, I'm going to design movies for just a small run of theaters. What these sort of new avenues for making an indie game and putting it on a console have done is allowed these very small teams, one or two people, to bat in the big leagues.
So at this moment, what's the impact of these independent games on consoles going to be?
You think about what happened in film, was that indie film came along, and some of the techniques of storytelling and acting techniques that the indies were doing in these tiny little films started bleeding into big Hollywood blockbusters. And I absolutely think the same thing is happening now, because you get these little players, one or two people who are making these very weird forms of play. The big studios are starting to pay attention because they're getting aware that you can do cool things if you have a cheaper budget. So they're starting to realize, well, maybe we should try and rein in these insane economics of our industry and be more creative at the same time. So I definitely think that the rise of sort of indie game makers is infecting and hopefully going to revitalize the mainstream of game design.
But give me an example. What weird, cool thing are these indies doing that could actually influence the big companies?
Here's a great example. There was this game called Flow. You sort of took control of this little amoeba. It didn't tell you what to do. You just sort of guided it around. Eventually, you'd see things. And when you got close to them, you could sort of eat it. And depending on what you ate, you would seem to go deeper or higher almost into the screen, as if you were descending into water going upwards through water. And you would encounter different things that were sort of trying to eat you. It was a very almost zen-like experience. That's what he intended to do. He wanted to make a game that would relax you. This was so successful, so popular, that he got a commission to do a zen-like game for the PlayStation 3 called Flower that just came out. You're blowing a flower petal around this very barren landscape, and as you blow it towards other little flowers, they open up, and you get these lovely bits of music and gusts of color. And eventually you get this huge flock of petals you're guiding around with this gust of air, and you're just trying to sort of bring the landscape back to life. It is playful, it is fun to do, but it actually chills you out. It calms you down, you know, which is a lovely thing for a video game to do. Something that if you went into a major game studio and said, you know, I want $20 million to do a game where you just blow petals around and it calms people down, they would have thought you were absolutely insane, right? So he had to do this by himself, just him and maybe a friend sitting at a computer to prove that it is cool and fun to make a game that calms you down. And then he was able to get a commission to do a different game with a much larger team on the PlayStation 3, and it's been a big hit.
It seems to me that calming down just strikes at the heart of what we assume video games are supposed to do.
That's just one example. There's a guy who made a game for the Xbox that has no graphics. So you load up the game and you're holding a controller. You just close your eyes and listen to stuff. You'll hear sounds and you try and move towards and move away from them. And I love that idea. A video game with no video, right? It's an audio game. So you're getting these really crazy, interesting experiments. They're really blowing open the idea of what a video game can be.
Well, let me ask you the big cultural question here. If, in fact, video games may become the largest form of home entertainment in America within the next year in terms of dollars spent, how will that change the culture?
I certainly would hope that this breeds, particularly if we get more inventive forms of game, a type of a cultural mindset that's more interested in the complexity of the world and complex systems. Because the one thing that you do when you play a video game is you sit down in a state of total ignorance. You don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't know how this game works. And the process of figuring out what to do is really what is fun about the game. In fact, people often stop playing the game once they figured it out. And that's a great inquisitive mindset that video games quite uniquely tap into. So, you know, 30 years from now, imagine a president who did this, you know, as their primary cultural activity for 25 years. I mean, I hope that's an interesting proposition. I hope it's a good proposition. We'll find out one way or another.
Thanks very much.
No problem.
Clive Thompson is a writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine. And now, a salute to librarians in general, and one in particular. On the Media admires librarians because they stand steadfast and brave on the side of free speech, even when the political wind or their own communities blow the other way. We've noted this year after year during citizen campaigns against books ranging from Heather Has Two Mommies to Huckleberry Finn, and when librarians lobbied long and hard against a provision in the Patriot Act that would compel them to release a client's book borrowing records without their knowledge. The best thing about librarians, though, is how much noise they make when the sanctity of their citadels is breached.
Libraries serve the information needs of everyone in the community that they serve. Not only the most popular people, not only the loudest, and not even only the majority. We serve the needs of those people that we wouldn't take home for dinner.
That's the librarian in particular who we wish to celebrate, Judith Krug, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom since it was founded in 1967. She died in Evanston, Illinois last Saturday at the age of 69. The ALA's annual Banned Books Week was Krug's brainchild. She said a book makes the list, not when people object to it, but when they demand its removal from library shelves.
The people who want materials removed really do feel very strongly. And if they feel that strongly, the way to protect their own value system is to make sure nothing's available to contradict it.
Back in the early 90s, during the kerfuffle over Madonna's salacious paean to sex called Sex, Krug said the book was, quote, sleazy trash, but it should be in every medium-sized library in the United States.
I like to say that your First Amendment rights end where my nose begins. That's where my First Amendment rights begin.
Judith Krug, who devoted her life to preserving that most fundamental of American values, was a true patriot.
Over 200 years ago, James Madison said it better than I could ever say it, when he said, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives." And ladies and gentlemen, we, the librarians of this country, hold that knowledge in our hands.
In my opinion, Judith Krug deserved the Medal of Freedom. All we can do is bestow our gratitude and offer this musical send-off about how librarians help us navigate the card catalog I think she'd appreciate.
'Cause she shows it to me and then she
does it with me, and then she smiles so happily when I can do it for myself. She's the interactive kind. When there are things that I need to find, oh, my librarian, she is so fine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido and Ethan Scheel, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.